I don't know.
Say it with me. I don't know.
Good God, it is liberating. I am a towering mountain of ignorance. I don't know.
We're taught to believe that everything has a reason.
And so we observe the world, we see what happened, and then we define the thing that happened as the reason the thing happened. But I think a lot of the time we end up mixing up thinking something with knowing something. This is why it can be so impossible to talk about certain topics with certain people. They've tied those suppositions to themselves so tightly with knots of narrative and constructed reality and values that there's just no untying it. And maybe unsurprisingly, in those situations, the best course of action is just to be friends. Maybe even ask them about that thing that they've created, because to them, it's immensely valuable. The world as we perceive it, as we've built it inside of ourselves, is a lie that we tell to ourselves, not out of deception, but out of necessity. We have no other choice. We simply cannot understand the world as it is, and so we construct. But sometimes I just have to tell myself the thing that is definitely true, the truest thing I can say, which is that I don't know.
This is the Everyone's Agnostic Podcast with Bob Pondillo and Cass Midgley.
The people who are most hurt and go through the most struggle in recovery are the people that were most sincere. You gave yourself to this religion. You gave yourself to Jesus, to God, to your beliefs, your identity, your life. And you were the most sincere person. And then it fell apart and it was devastating. Lights will guide you home and ignite your bones. And I will try.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Cass Midgley. That was a clip from our conversation with Dr. Marlene Wynell, author of Leaving the Fold and founder of JourneyFree.org. Marlene's parents were Christian missionaries in China with the Assemblies of God. She left Christianity because of sexism, the notion of original sin, the dichotomy of saved and damned, and the broken promises within Scripture, to name a few. She now counsels people and leads retreats for those damaged by religion. She calls it Religious Trauma Syndrome, or RTS. This interview surprised me. Marlene's diagnosis of post-religious heartbreak brought me to tears, not during the taping, but when I listened back to it. Leaving Christianity was the best thing I've ever done for myself and my family, but it was difficult, very painful and lonely, a pilgrimage that is still ongoing, but I've never been happier or healthier. As Marlene writes in her book, there was no turning back. The mental and emotional doors to the future had been opened. The honesty and gut-level confrontation with my humanness, the good, the bad, and the ugly, was delicious. As David Bazan sings, I swung my tassel to the left side of my cap, knowing after graduation there would be no going back. If you or someone you know is on the courageous journey of deconstructing and reconstructing their faith, Marlene Wynell's insights are very life-giving. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and most podcast platforms. If you feel grateful for our podcast, Patreon.com is like a tip jar for our work. That's patreon.com/EAPodcast. Have a great week, everybody, and enjoy the conversation. I can't remember how I heard about you, Marlene. I get people send us recommendations and say, hey, you know, this is somebody that you should talk to. But your ministry, if you want to call it that. Now, you're a therapist, right? I mean, what's your degrees?
I have a PhD in human development and family studies from Penn State.
Oh, that's
good,
nice.
Good school.
Yeah.
Are you from the Northeast then?
No.
Originally?
I'm an import. I was born in Hong Kong, grew up in Taiwan. My parents were missionaries.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah, Assembly of God missionaries. I came to Southern California when I was 16.
Wow.
Yeah, and then I was part of the Jesus movement in Southern California. I was a pretty zealous Christian myself.
Mm-hmm. No kidding. Wow.
Are your parents still living?
My mother is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She's still Assembly of God? And...
Well, not actively. I mean, she's retired, and but she's still very much Christian, yeah.
What does she think about your departure?
Well, pretty sad, although we're still on good terms.
That's a tough nuance to the relationship. I have the same with my mom, as far as she's still very much Christian, and she cries at the thought of me not being Christian. I was an evangelical minister for 20 years. I was her pastor. And my father died of cancer when I was 17. He was 58. And I'm her only son, and I was her pastor. So there's a lot of affinity there to where she looks to me as a spiritual leader, as the man in her life, et cetera, et cetera. And so I have completely broken her heart. In fact, we tried to keep it from her, but it didn't.
Not a good idea.
Well, no. Yeah, it didn't work. So does that mean you were born out of the country, or?
Yeah, and also just to finish answering your question about my background, I also lived in Colorado and became a licensed psychologist there and had a practice there for a long time.
Very good.
How old were you when you began to question or doubt your faith?
I was very much curious about all sorts of questions. Even in junior high and high school, I did a lot of studying of the Bible and was much more serious about it than a lot of my peers. And then I started having some questions, some serious questions about whether or not some things about the Bible were valid in high school. And then in college, of course, I started getting a lot more information and started getting exposed to some consciousness-raising ideas like feminism, and then exposed to people that had other belief systems that were pretty valid and coherent. People weren't necessarily crazy or stupid or evil, and and they were still happy. And this surprised me. I thought we had a corner on everything meaningful. And so it was a combination of pushes and pulls, you might say. And so by the end of college and shortly after, it took a number of years. And then I also fell in love and got into a relationship and then eventually got married. And that made a big difference, too, because I think there's a lot of dependency in a religious relationship with God, you know, where you're getting certain needs met that can get met in human relationships. So it was a whole combination of things.
Wow.
So did you marry a Christian?
No, not really. He was raised in a very nominal Presbyterian household, you know, the kind of Christian that as an evangelical you wouldn't consider real.
Right, Christian light.
And I was going to Calvary Chapel in Southern California, and this was like the hippie version of Christianity at the time. And
right.
The Jesus freaks, and they were baptizing people at the beach.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was trying to get a relationship going with me. And I wasn't doing the evangelical dating, but I did start seeing him and then got him into church and got him baptized at the beach. And then we got married.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It's interesting that you're the child of missionaries and you were living in a culture where they were basically trying to convert people to Christianity, right?
Oh, sure, yeah.
So early on, you were exposed to cultures and other religions. And is there a sense where sometimes we have to demonize, like you said, one of the epiphanies that you had was you met people from other cultures, other religions, and they weren't bad people, and they weren't monsters or something. So, and yet, it still hit you later in college that you were continuing to discover other cultures or religions.
Well, in Taiwan, there was a huge separation. I mean, these were Taiwanese and Chinese people, and they were very foreign, and they were so different. You know, they were Buddhists and Taoists, and my parents, I mean, we spoke Chinese, and they were doing this missionary work while we kids, even though we interacted with them a little bit, we went to American schools.
Yeah.
And when I got older, I went to an American missionary school, a boarding school.
So surrounded by Americans.
Yeah, and a Christian one. Mm-hmm. So it was very insulated that way.
Yeah. So you grow up assembly. You begin to have questions and doubts as early as high school and certainly college. College is, you know, information is hard on religion. And I know, you know, I had my own doubts and bouts with philosophy and loved it. And yet it was taboo for me. It was almost, I was just trying to think as I knew you were coming on, I was trying to think back on my journey because I've been deconstructing for the last 10 years. Uh-huh. And so I'm a little removed from the freshness of the emotions of the pain and the sorrow and the horror of deconstructing. But I do remember that as a Christian, reading material outside of the Christian bookstore lexicon was forbidden, and it had a dark feel to it. And I remember like reading material that questioned God or even that mocked God, and it was almost the same feeling of reading porn or watching ISIS or something to where this is a dark, dark world, and I must be dancing with devils to even be here. Yeah. And so there's this foreboding and ominous feel of I'm betraying God as we speak, and these people are mocking my best friend and my lover and my spouse and the man who died on a cross for me. So this is evil at its core, and I'm dancing with it, oh my God, and just, you know, running out of the building or whatever, you know.
like you're on fire.
And so I do think that part of the conversion for me was, for some reason, I allowed myself to entertain the notion that Adam and Eve were fictional. And I know I'd heard that many times before, but this time I let it get past my outer guard, and boy, the bedrock of my life just rattled.
Wow.
So what was it for you? What were the catalytic moments where you really started to head down the road of deconstruction?
Well, before I answer that, I just find it's an interesting story, and just cognitively I'm imagining this dike that you've constructed against all this information, and then there's this tiny leak where you let that one little bit in.
Yep. That's a great metaphor.
Yeah.
And then it starts to crack the whole thing, doesn't it?
Yep. So what was it for you?
I think that for me, it was, like I said, it was pushes and pulls. I think it was more meeting people that were happy and functioning and did not seem to need the message I was trying to give them.
Yep. I relate to that. In fact, Bob, my co-host and one of my best friends in town here, was that guy for me, because when I first met Bob, I mean, he was just the super sweetest, kindest, funnest, happiest guy, and he was an atheist, you know, and so the darkness wasn't there, and that was a dissonance, you know, that I had to reconcile.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Marlene, when I first met Cass, I felt, my gosh, this guy is like carrying these heavy weights with him, these chains, you know, he's all cluttered up. His mind is so cluttered up with other things. It's, I don't know, I hope he's going to be okay, you know, that type of stuff, because I've never had that experience.
And I want to come back to that, because now I do something that's kind of like counter-witnessing.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you about an occasion of that, because it's really fun.
Okay.
But the other thing that was a factor was, early on in my college career, I started taking psychology classes. Mm-hmm. And psychology was a big, big eye-opener because, well, first of all, you know that in Christianity, they don't want to have any knowledge of psychology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're afraid of it. Right. Especially Freud, because he was so anti-religion.
But any kind of psychology, anything that tries to explain anything about human behavior, human needs, or human feelings, it's going to unravel the Christian story, because it's going to have this completely other explanation. That's why people aren't supposed to see secular therapists for anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real problem, too, when people have left the faith, when they need help. They're very scared to go to get professional help when they're seriously having problems. And I face that because, you know, I try to reach out to help people.
Sure.
And that's the first hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunate because if you're traumatized by something else, you know, like if you've been sexually abused or you've been through anything else, you know, you call somebody or somebody helps you get in touch with somebody. You don't have to get past this big issue that it's wrong to get help.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Like you do with religion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of people to this day that don't like to, they refuse to accept medications. You know, they refuse to go to psychologists. And yet there's all this help out there to help them. But they think they've got to do it on their own. They've got to be strong or they've got to be, you know, and it's like, my gosh, if you had diabetes, you'd take insulin. What's the problem? You know, you should go see somebody.
People get told that psychology itself is a demonic thing,
yeah,
you know?
Sure.
That psychology is something that gives this alternative, secular, worldly view of mm-hmm. explaining human behavior that's godless,
right.
You know?
Right.
That basically tells you that your depression is because of this, this, and this, instead of because you're sinning, because you're separate from God.
Yeah.
See, the religious view of everything that's wrong, everything that's troubling you, is because you're not close to God.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you just get right with God, if you just confess your sin, then you're going to be good. You're going to be happy. You're going to be fine. And so that's the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And early on in my college years, actually, when I was my undergraduate was in social ecology from the University of California at Irvine. And it's a little bit like social work, except that it's broader and it's more community-based. And we had to do field studies and do projects in the community. And one of the things I did was I started a hotline on a community center where people could drop in. And at the time, I was still Christian. And so and actually Chuck Smith helped start this too. I got some funding from Calvary Chapel they gave us the rent for our building for the first month and said that if the Lord gave us money after that, then we could continue. And lo and behold, we did get some money, so I guess the Lord was in it.
Yeah.
So we had this hotline, and I recruited all these volunteers. But, you know, and this was part of my process and part of my changes, because I realized after a while that we had the same answer for everybody, no matter what people called about. And I realized after a while we didn't do any listening. And that, in general, Christians don't listen because we always have the same freaking answer.
Yeah.
Yes. A little more God. Get a little closer.
Yep.
Get right with God.
So back to what you were asking about what kind of started unraveling it. You know, so I'm taking a psychology class, and we're talking about how people learn and become who they are, and little children, and this was actually a behavioral class, and so we're talking about reinforcement and punishment and social learning theory, and so, you know, things like if somebody's treated violently, they learn to be violent,
mm-hmm.
right?
Sure.
And so forth, and how much of what we do is just plain learned? Well, so what does that do to the notion of sin?
Mm-hmm.
What does that do to the notion of responsibility for how you behave? So it started to really erode. And by the way, this, I noticed one of your questions was a pet peeve. Holding small children responsible for sin,
mm-hmm.
like a baby responsible for crying, calling that evidence of original sin.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy.
Mm. Yeah. It's just crazy, crazy stuff.
Yeah.
The notion of sin just started falling apart as I learned about psychology, because people are complex and they learn to behave. Let's say, you know, child abuse. A parent beats you up and then you beat up your little brother. Well, you know, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Sure.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And then you get punished for being violent and the violence continues.
Because the punishment is violence, yeah.
And then that continues and goes on and on. And you can see how one thing leads to another, and pretty soon my understanding of human behavior starts getting more and more complex, and it doesn't fit into the Christian paradigm anymore.
No.
Sure.
Well, one thing that we learned, I'm sure, Marlene, you're familiar with this, is that we learned early on of the whole reward and punishment thing. So in a way, life itself, like existing, walking out your daily life, was overseen by this celestial parent who was guiding us into truth, thus kind of our teacher. And so everything that happened to us was God trying to teach us something. So we, even if we did something that we knew was willfully sinful, there was just this expectation that I'm going to get punished for this because he punishes those he loves. If he doesn't punish me, he doesn't love me. So you kind of wanted the punishment. It's a little sadomasochistic, but
yeah.
But you're just, you're constantly looking into every occurrence as this happened for a reason.
Right.
And I think we, you know, you referred to the aversion to, you know, the distrust of science and psychology, because psychology can tell you when you're praying and you think you're hearing God, we have a scientific, you know, we have a scientific explanation for that.
Yeah.
We know that you're talking to yourself. And of course, all of Christendom knows that this science is going to explain God away, and they have to guard against that. Now, having said that, I want to go back because I was reading your book last night, and I was interested, and Bob, you may know some of the history of fundamentalism and where
some.
That comes from. And it's around 1910, 1915, in that area,
yeah.
where they, in response to the Enlightenment and in response to science and
modernism, and eventually the Scopes trial, that was huge.
Yeah, well, they had to set in stone these fundamentals, because it's basically they had to, you know, guard and protect what was now being threatened. Mm-hmm. And so when somebody feels cornered, they come out fighting. And so that's this whole reaction that we now call fundamentalism started in the early 1900s and has just swelled, you know, to here we are, because that was 1915, here we are 2015.
Yeah,
100 years later...
Fundamentalism kind of eroded after the Scopes trial. They kind of went away for a while and kind of just went, did their own thing. And then eventually in the 1950s, with the coming of communism and stuff, then we saw this big wave.
Yeah.
And then eventually in the 60s come the Flower Children.
Well, and in God We Trust,
Jesus
in
Freaks
53.
And all that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, somewhere in there, the moral majority got started,
yep.
Right?
Right.
Yeah. More in the 70s, I would guess. Around Reagan, the time of Reagan. Yeah.
Well, even Francis Schaeffer, we've had Frank Schaeffer, his son, on the show, but Francis Schaeffer's books were a part of girding up that get involved in politics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's always a reaction.
Yeah, it seems to be.
And there was a call for publicity. Like they were saying, hey, we shouldn't be a subculture. We need to be out there and we need to be involved in politics.
Engage.
We need men of God in office, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, that whole movement. Anyway, I don't know that that's a question more than we're just kind of surveying history.
I do have a comment about that because,
sure.
And by the way, I'm glad you had Frank on the show. He's a friend of mine.
Yeah, he's a good guy, great guy.
Fundamentalist religions, all of them, but Christianity especially, is based on fear.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally based on fear. And so if you have something that's going to crank up some fear, like communism or the wars, and just create insecurity, then it's going to create those things. The part of the narrative is end times.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Sure.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Big part.
And so you have these apocalyptic visions going on, and you have Hal Lindsey writing that book about the end times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Late Great Planet Earth.
That one.
Yeah. Late Great Planet Earth, which we all read. And when I was a Jesus freak, we all thought Jesus was coming any day.
Mm-hmm.
It was urgent.
Mm-hmm.
When I was deciding to go to college, I was deciding between Oral Roberts University and University of California. I chose University of California because that was a place where I could be a witness. It wasn't because I was going to get a better education there.
Mm. And Marlene, that's why you're an atheist today. That's where a road less traveled. You would have gone to Oral Roberts. You would be a believer today.
Instead, I met Satan.
That's right.
You're bride of Satan.
Now I have these here horns on my head.
Isn't that interesting that the urgency of the return of Christ has been maintained since he... 21 centuries.
Yeah.
It could happen any time. It could happen any time. It could happen any time.
Know,
it could
I
happen
know.
Any time.
Well, here's what I keep saying. You know, when people say, well, why aren't you a Christian? You know, you believe and blah, blah, blah. And I go, well, you know, there's only really one really good reason why I would just quit being a Christian, is that he has not come back. He said he was coming back, and he has not come back. If you had a date,
and yeah, you're waiting on the porch.
You know, I saw somebody, I don't know if it was a t-shirt or a bumper or whatever, and it just said, Jesus, he's just not that into you.
Yeah, right. Yeah. When are you going to get the message? Your prom date.
He never came back. And he said he would come, and he didn't. And so he said, I come quickly. And I don't think he meant that he was a premature ejaculator.
I hear you.
So, Marlene, I think this end times thing is worth talking about for a second, because the prophecies all say that in the end times, well, in the whole wheat and the tares, that the wheat's going to grow and the tares are going to grow, that good's going to rise and evil's going to rise. And they would say this advancement of equal rights for gay marriage is a part of the advancement of evil, and so we have to keep up.
Yeah, sure.
And there's scriptures that talk about where girls... Yeah. acted like men or wanted to dress like men, and men wanted to dress like girls. And this was a sign of the end times. Well, transgenderness is completely, you know, exploding as far as people feeling comfortable to come out,
right,
finally, because of this religious phobia. So they see all this stuff that we see as progress. They see it pointing to the return of Christ, which is something they want to happen. They want the return of Christ.
But the thing is, it's taking a long time. And in other words, Jesus has taken his sweet time coming back. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, okay, so prior to this, the Christians had this attitude of separation, you know, mm-hmm. in the world, but not of the world.
Right.
And they stayed away from politics. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty much considered wrong to get all involved in the world. You know, the world was a phrase that meant, you know, bad, you stay away from it. Mm-hmm. And then my take on it is that it's shifted. You know, the church keeps morphing in the way that it treats things, because, you know, according to the times. And then it got this idea that, oh, well, okay, let's dive in there because he's not here. So the moral majority gets started, and now all of a sudden they're going to get political.
Mm. Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Right, right.
Well, they're ambassadors. He's not here, but he sent us, and this is his nation, and so we need to declare him Jesus is Lord of America. Yeah.
So now they're going to take part, and they're going to do what he should be doing, and they're going to try and alter how Christian our nation is, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Because the idea is that God blessing whole nations, you know, and withdrawing his blessing from a nation.
Yep.
You know, that whole thing, like the way he supposedly did in the Old Testament with punishing whole nations.
Right.
And if there are too many people in a country that is sinning, then God will send his punishment down like Sodom and Gomorrah. Mm. So you can get somebody like Jerry Falwell saying something outrageous about 9/11, blaming it on sinners, you know, gays and lesbians and all sinning, mm-hmm. bringing God's punishment and saying that that was God's punishment.
Yep.
Wow. It truly is a leap of faith, or a leap of something. I don't know what it is.
And so by following this logic, the anger and the resentment, and this includes things like abortion too, and women's rights, is a fear that they are the ones that are going to get punished for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and even this week, there was somebody, I was trying to Google it real quick, but there's a talking head somewhere that said, whoever is more zealous for their God wins. And right now, ISIS is being more zealous for their God. And there was this call. It was a Christian guy talking, and it was a call to the base, to rouse the base, saying, why aren't we as aggressive for our God as ISIS is about theirs? And it was because there is this notion that whoever has God on their side wins.
Wow.
It's why Constantine adopted it.
Yeah.
That's why he co-opted Christianity, is because he thought, okay, well, I need to win wars, and he literally put up a flag, right?
Yeah,
the Christian flag, just in hopes that would be the key to winning the battle.
He had a vision. You will conquer under the sign. Under the sign, you will conquer.
Yeah.
You will be victorious. Yeah.
Well, I find it helpful to look at things not only through the lens of psychology, but evolutionary psychology.
Sure.
Mm. It's been very useful. I mean, this is all extremely tribal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
In terms of religion, it's very Old Testament.
Yep.
It's as if the gospel doesn't even exist.
Mm-hmm.
This thing, and you know, it's very Old Testament.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. For sure. We talk all the time about how really Christianity is, because the Bible is truly their God. Jesus is not their Lord. He's not their master teacher. The Bible's their master teacher. They get more instruction from Paul and Moses than they ever do Jesus. In fact, if they would elevate the teachings of Jesus over the rest,
mm-hmm.
and actually acknowledge that, okay, we're going to say Jesus is not just a human, he's God incarnate, why wouldn't they elevate his teachings?
Yeah.
But they don't. They equate them because it's all canonized.
Yeah.
So literally the teachings of Jesus are equated, as far as gravitas, with mm-hmm. every other author yeah. in the Bible. And because, you know, there's just little snippets of what Jesus yeah. said compared to the other volumes of what... I mean, Paul...
Oh my gosh.
Over half the New Testament is written by Paul or pseudo-Paul.
Yeah, that's true.
That's why it carries more gravity.
Marlene, help me. I'm getting so depressed. I don't know what to do. I'm really serious. I don't know what to do. It's like there's powerful forces against us.
You get right with God and you're
oh, you got your pat answer.
No, but I mean, is there, gosh, it just seems insurmountable, this problem. Am I full of shit or what? I mean, what should I do? I feel, you know, impotent.
Well, you feel like you live in a world that's just completely
crazy.
It's what is it you call
up,
it? A bizarro world.
The bizarro world. Up is down is up, you know, nothing seems to make sense. Well, and I'm sure you get people like that that come to you and say, what should I do, you know?
Well, one thing that's got to change, I firmly believe, is that the topic of religion has got to be on the table. It has, you know, on a political level, on a sociological level, it can't be this private little discussion that we're having here.
Yeah.
I mean, because what we're talking about now, this is like what all the crap that we're talking about, all these beliefs that we're talking about, these are things that are closely held by most of Congress.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, and that's kind of a problem.
Well, that's why Bob's depressed.
Yes,
okay,
I'm so sad.
We're about halfway through or in, and I just can't get away from having you talk about, I just think that you're a wealth of information because you've done so much counseling with people, including yourself, but I mean the amount of people that you've talked to about their post-religious trauma. I just want to hear stories. I want to hear, what have you learned? What have you discovered are the most recurring problems or elements of damage that those that you've counseled, either in private or in group settings, what are they saying were the hardest things to get over?
I want to say one last thing about what you were just talking about, and that is that Christianity, as we were talking about it, as the fundamentalist version, the Old Testament version,
right.
Christianity is a death cult.
Yep.
Okay? Mm-hmm. It's a death cult because it focuses on the death of Jesus Christ as, you know, supposedly an atonement for sin.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it also focuses on what's going to happen to you after you die.
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to be concerned about eternity and going to heaven instead of hell. They believe in heaven and hell as literal places.
Sure.
This world is not important.
Mm-hmm.
This world can just burn. That's why climate change doesn't matter.
Right.
This world doesn't matter. That's why all the billions of people that are going to go to hell don't matter. All that matters is that you get your ticket to heaven. Everything else can just go to hell. Whereas, if you follow the teachings of Jesus, as you were just saying,
mm-hmm.
Jesus was talking about, Jesus in many, many places, mm-hmm. was very harsh on rich people.
Mm-hmm.
And when he talked about hell, he was condemning rich people to hell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the story of Lazarus and being in hell.
At the king's gate, yeah.
And Matthew 25, when he talks about taking care of the poor.
Mm-hmm.
He would get really angry in those moments. So the liberal churches, the ones that we used to call nominal Christians and didn't even consider them Christians, those people, the people that Frank Schaeffer would align with,
mm-hmm.
are the people that focus on Jesus' life and Jesus' teachings,
mm-hmm.
and don't consider his death to be all that important. They don't even consider the resurrection to be a true story.
Right.
They don't believe in heaven and hell.
Mm-hmm.
They focus on Jesus' teachings, and they call themselves Christians. And originally, the word Christian meant follower of Christ, and they meant Christian teachings.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be focus on his life. But Christianity, in the way that we've been talking to it, is completely a death cult. That's why Christopher Hitchens, he would call it that. It was totally focused on death, and that's why he called it so dangerous.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because the Frank Schaeffers and you and I, and really, I consider myself in conversation with progressive Christians because I think they're saving Christianity, and the far right thinks they're destroying it. And so there's this tug of war over Christianity, and that's why sometimes I just say, fuck it. We don't even need the damn thing. And it just it's causing more division than anything. Let's just skip it.
Yeah.
And so sometimes these attempts to salvage it are maddening.
I don't think we need to salvage it at all.
Another thing about Jesus' teaching before you, now you've got me thinking about something that I thought you were going to say. Instead of an emphasis on the afterlife and on you know the death cult type infatuations, Jesus was saying the kingdom of God is now.
Right. The kingdom of God is within you. It says that in Luke, anyway.
Yeah, it's within reach is another mm-hmm. way that he put it. And and so there was. It seemed like, okay, so the Old Testament doesn't emphasize the afterlife. Jesus doesn't emphasize the afterlife. He kind of does, but there's a contradiction there, and we never know if Jesus, what he said or what he didn't say, because he didn't write anything down. But at least there's so much more material on the here and now in the Bible that I think it is the very fundamentalists that we're talking about that hijacked the emphasis to go to the afterlife. You're dead right in saying that the Bible says that God's going to create a new heaven, a new earth. He's literally going to discard this earth like an old garment. There's scriptures that say invest in the afterlife. You know, don't invest in things that moths can eat and rust destroy.
Yeah.
And of course, the Gospel of John is a complete demonization of the world. Yeah. Ironically, it's also 3:16 where he said God so loved the world, which is the word cosmos. But throughout John, it's like be not of the world. Come out. Mm-hmm. Come and be apart. Be separate. What does light have in common with darkness? And so there's this contrast of you are not like them. It's the us and them. You know, great, you know, giant chasm. And this is tribal. We get that, but it so pleases. And here we go with psychology, the ego, because I need to be in the club, and I need for you to be out because you scare me. Whether it's the color of your skin or whatever, all these fears. It's xenophobia, a foreigner. Misogyny, you're a vagina, I'm a penis, so I don't trust you, I fear you, and I have to keep you down.
Yeah,
and I have
sure.
to keep you separate, and I have to, you know, all this stuff. So there's all this fear of the other.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to have, I mean, even they've said it on the earth. They've said we need to put all these faggots on an island. You know, so they've created in their minds, they say it out loud, we need a place to put these people so they're not with us. And that's what hell is. And it fed it from childhood. It got indoctrinated into them as children before they had cognitive critical thinking skills to filter stuff. And so it became a part of their construct. And it's the lens through which they see everything going forward as an adult. And this is where it's brain damaged. This is mm-hmm. where it's toxic and traumatizing. So this is why I'm fascinated with your work, Marlene, because you're opening up your doors and your ears to say, tell me your story, to let's talk about the limp that you walk with and have for the, you know, since you left Christianity. And so that's why I feel like I wish, you know, I know you got a retreat coming up in April, and mm-hmm. and you know, we're out here in the South, you're in the West, so I don't even, and people listen to this at any time, like they, it's not like a radio show where it's live, they download it whenever they want to. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know that necessarily we're going to be able to generate participants into your retreats,
yeah,
but I would love to be one of them. I mean, I want to be a fly on the wall or a participant in a way to hear what other people are saying. And so that's my question is, what are the stories that you're hearing over the years? What are some of the most recurring stories of pain and suffering? Because I think this is a hard sell. I think people are still, saying, oh, come on. Nothing dangerous about it. Listen, don't compare post-traumatic stress disorder with, don't compare war. How dare you compare sexual abuse and military trauma with religious trauma? Oh, come on. Religion's not that bad. I think this is a hard sell. That's why I think we need to go there.
Okay, so if this is a hard sell, who are we talking to right now?
Well, okay, that's a great question. I guess anybody on the fence, like those... I'd say most of my listeners, it's not a hard sell. They already know that religion almost ruined their life. And I know that there's a lot of shame and regret. Here's the thing about shame. Within Christianity, you're shamed for being human. Okay, so then when you get out of it, I felt a whole nother layer of shame for the credulity that I mean, I'm embarrassed that I believed it into my late 30s. I'm ashamed of that. I'm ashamed to talk about that. And then now look at, like, a lot of my current friends and family still believe it. So I can't express my embarrassment in front of them without embarrassing them. I wish they were embarrassed. They don't want to feel that. But
yeah.
So this is an extremely complex conversation killer, relationship killer.
Yeah. Let's let Marlene talk.
Let's let Marlene talk.
That's my job is to put the brakes on sometimes. Anyway, go ahead, Marlene. What I mean, it's a great question about
I was just wondering about your audience because it is a big topic. Are we mostly talking to people that are ex believers?
Yes, I would say 99% of our listeners are ex believers.
Or they're going through this new journey. They're on a new journey and they're confused and trying to figure it all out. We get a lot of that.
Okay, so to an extent, they'll understand that there is definitely a big adjustment. And it turns out that right now I've been asked to write a chapter for an anthology, the Oxford Manual on Secularism. And I've been asked to write the chapter on the issues of newly non-religious people. And the more I work on the chapter, it's like this could be a book because the issues of... And it's not just difficulties. There's also some really great things. And one of the pieces that I wrote for exchristian.net was hats off to the courageous because I was just right. I just felt compelled to write this piece honoring people that have left their religion because there is this courage involved. Because you know what? Your whole reality gets ripped out from under you.
Yep.
Yes.
It's very courageous. I totally agree. It was horrible, yeah.
And people who haven't been through that really have no way of understanding. And which also brings up the fact that it's hard to find people to really talk to because you can't talk to the people that are still in.
Right.
They will try to bring you back. Or they will shun you because they don't want to deal with it.
Yep.
And you can't talk to people that are secular because they don't know what you're talking about. They don't understand why it's difficult.
Yeah, that's Bob's question. Why is it so hard?
Sometimes even be as trite as saying, "Isn't this like finding out there's no Santa Claus?" And therapists are not trained. Sometimes therapists will say things like that. Sometimes therapists don't want to deal with it. Sometimes therapists will try to use spirituality and religion to try to help you,
mm-hmm.
like in the 12-step program,
mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, higher power.
And therapist training programs in graduate school, they will treat spirituality like diversity. You're supposed to respect people's religion and help them use it as part of their getting better. Then they won't treat it like it could possibly be harmful. I was at a conference in Italy on psychology and religion and on presenting religious trauma syndrome. And I was the only one in the whole conference that was talking about religion as being potentially harmful.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, and this is what I mean about it's got to be on the table.
Yeah. Well, this is what I mean by it being a hard sell.
Can't be a taboo subject. Mm-hmm. And therapists can't be afraid to deal with it. Because okay, so one of the things I want to say to people that are in recovery, and you included, is that the people who are most hurt and go through the most struggle in recovery are the people that were most sincere. You devoted yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Often they are people who had a sensitive personality, mm-hmm. who, in other words, you had some emotionality. You gave yourself to this religion. You gave yourself to Jesus, to God, to your beliefs. And you wanted to do the best. You gave yourself your identity, your life.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to do the best thing you could with your life. You sought God's will for your life. You wanted to have meaning in your life, and you gave yourself over. and you were the most sincere person. And then it fell apart, and it was devastating.
Yep.
And it was devastating to you in a way that it would not be devastating to somebody who simply went to church because you had to, because your parents made you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or it was a social thing. And for a lot of people, it is a social thing. For a lot of people who go to church, because religion fulfills a lot of different needs, for a lot of people, it is a club. Mm-hmm. So if you decide not to go anymore, you can quit. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, there was an organization called Walk Away, and they tried to convince people that they shouldn't make it a big deal. They should just walk away. Mm-hmm. And to make it a big deal was like inventing a problem. And they missed the point because it depends on who you are.
Yeah. I think you're onto something there, because I was all in. I mean, and I was all in. Mm-hmm. And
how could you not?
Well, there's a lot of people that don't. That's yeah. that's her point, is that you have two different, and mm-hmm. I hate to even use two because it sounds binary, and but that's...
Yeah.
But there's at least two, and what we're contrasting is people that were social Christians. And to some degree, the walk away was similar to Santa Claus because they weren't invested deeply. The pain wasn't deeply to tear away.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But when you're invested, heart, mind, soul, every fiber of your being is giving yourself to this. Then when you do tear away, that's a different pain.
Yeah, Marlene, it sounds almost like a marriage breakup or something. You know what I mean? That type of pain that a person goes through when they're completely invested in somebody else.
It can be wrenching. I mean, I know one person. He's a friend of mine who spent 3 days in bed. You know.
Sure.
I mean, somebody had to bring him food. I mean, he was just devastated. And there are plenty of stories like that because it's like everything you knew is wrong.
Or a lie.
From everything that the world means, everything that. What other people mean, what you mean, you know, yourself, the cosmos, the future, life itself, everything is shattered.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm amazed at how many things have never been linked to religion or loss of religion. Like there's one thing called shattered assumption syndrome. Shattered assumption trauma or something like that. I can't remember the exact name. But it's when all of your assumptions about the world are shattered. And what they're referring to is like when you've been in a serious accident and you thought the world was a safe place.
Mm-hmm.
But that's exactly what happens. All of your assumptions are shattered.
Right. Wow.
And so when somebody says, you know, isn't it like Santa Claus? I said, no, it's more like finding out your mother wasn't real.
Wow.
There you go.
Wow, that's, yeah.
Well, and I'm interested in this, we're affected by religion, and in some ways we're not aware, we don't link it back to religion, because we were like a fish in water,
right.
It's just the fish doesn't know what water is. Mm-hmm. And it's so prevailing, especially if you were reared in it, it just becomes a part of your synapses, it becomes a part of your entire paradigm. So... A couple of things came to mind as I was preparing last night to speak with you. I have come to believe that what the world needs is a sense of connectivity. I think that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I think we are our brother's keeper, to use a Bible story. I think that when we feel connected to the earth, connected to our neighbor, that we're responsible for making this planet work and sustaining it,
mm-hmm.
that I think is a high priority. So what we don't, one of the things that we don't always realize, and I would say we being theists, mm-hmm. that Christians don't realize, is that they walk around with a sense of disconnectivity.
Mm.
They're disconnected to the earth, like we've already talked about. It's going to pass away. We're emphasis on the afterlife. They're disconnected with self. Because they have been told since childhood that as they are depraved. You are a sinful, disgusting existence. There's literally scriptures that talk about you're a stench in God's nostrils. And the only way that he could even tolerate you is to kill you and torture you. But instead of doing it to you, he was so loving that he vicariously did it to himself by his manifestation of his incarnate self. He beat up and tortured Jesus. This is a picture of how he really feels about you. This is what you deserve. You deserve to be tortured and hung on a cross and killed. But because I love you so much, I've got to take that anger somewhere else. But the anger's there. And so the message is loud and clear. You disgust God. And that's right, you know, you're grown up with that. So there's a disconnect from yourself. You don't trust yourself. The Bible says don't trust your wicked heart. Don't trust your ideas. Don't trust man's thinking. This, again, is the distrust of science and psychology. And then we don't trust others. And this is where I was talking about misogyny and and xenophobia. And there's this disconnect. So the greatest thing the world needs is connectivity. And one of the largest sources of opposing that virtue is religion. But we haven't made that. Christians don't make that connection. And here's why. Because in the subculture of their little church, they love one another. Why? Because they're in.
They're
the ins and outs, the us's and the them's. These are the us's. And so we can have fellowship dinners that feel really loving. They can have communities that feel really warm and caring and loving. And so they have this mythology of, what are you talking about? We're loving. We're not hateful. Yeah. I mean, hate crime came into existence because of religiosity's overreach. What are you talking about? We're the most loving people on the planet. Well, you love yours. You love your own. And that's actually a biblical commandment to love your own. So anyway, I'm just saying that I totally agree that I think we're swimming in the water. We don't often connect these vices to religion. Mm. And so this is why when you come out, like Marlene and I come out and say, and you, Bob, we come out and say, hey, religion is bad. Religion poisons everything, Christopher Hitchens.
Yeah.
They're like, what are you talking about? Religion is great. You know?
Yeah.
That's what I mean by a hard sell to some degree. All right, so I looked up theory of shattered assumptions. It's a phenomenon in psychology that describes how trauma can change our understanding of the world. This theory states that all people hold three main assumptions about the world and ourselves. In summation, the assumptions state that the world is benevolent, and as members of the world, we are meaningful and worthy. However, in the face of trauma, the theory claims that these assumptions are shattered and no one can no longer identify with these views. I would call it absurdity what Camus, you know, said. You're gonna look right into the face of absurdity and you're going to have to make a choice, you know, and either say yes to it like Nietzsche or whatever. So, I've talked too much.
No, it's fine. No, in fact, the thing you're saying about disconnection is something very similar to what I said in the introduction of my book. So I totally agree.
I got it from your book. No, well, actually, it came out. And I know that we have the extremes. You list the extremes in your book. The exploitation by televangelists of old women and gullible, credulous people. That's an extreme evil that's going on day in and day out, making millions and buying fucking Learjets for these motherfuckers. And then you have brainwashing, like we've talked about, the indoctrination of children. And then within the Catholic Church, the massive sexual abuse. And the suppression of sexuality here so that the river flows over here in places that it's inappropriate because we've
dammed it up.
We've dammed it up here.
Yeah, exactly.
So these are the extreme evils that I think most people can see, the more subtle things. And I was trying to think of my personal journey in that. What is one of the things that I've had to recover the most from? And it is, I think it's the shattered assumption thing. I'd never heard of this before today. But it is this carrying around the notion that everything happens for a reason and like giving meaning to everything.
Mm-hmm.
So if the stoplight changes, you know, there's a meaning there. We've talked about parking spaces and saying, oh, God must be for me.
That is, I don't understand why people think that way. It's entropy. There's more chaos than anything else. So what's the problem? I mean, there is no. It doesn't make any sense. Right. We make it.
I'll give you an example. Yesterday, I was making lunch in my office, and I had this bowl, and it's a paper bowl, like paper plate, but a paper bowl.
All right.
And it's full of white chili, which is white beans and chicken and stuff, and it's kind of sloppy and heavy. And this bowl is getting soggier and soggier the longer I keep reheating it into the microwave. And I'm holding it in one hand. I'm kind of pinning it against my chest. and I stumble.
Mm-hmm.
And I literally, like, somehow maneuver so not one drop of that chili spilled.
Mm.
And my knee-jerk reaction was, thank you, Jesus. I'm not kidding you. Really? I'm not kidding you. And I felt like I must be in the favor of God because he just spared that from happening. So let's say that you're in traffic and you slam on your brakes and you come inches away from hitting the car in front of you, but it doesn't happen. What is the first thing that people say?
Oh, God? I don't know.
Well, thank God.
Thank God, yes.
That was close.
Yeah.
God's must be looking out for me. The angels are watching over me.
So they immediately go to the supernatural.
Cass, how long have you been out of your religion?
10 years, but I was 39 when I started the deconstruction, and I'll be 49 next week.
Wow.
So I'm just saying, neural pathways, man, you know, they're formed.
Yeah, okay.
And let's say that I know this for a fact, too, that if that chili had spilled, I subconsciously and within nanoseconds, I would have gone to, what have I done? What have I done that God is punishing me? I would have.
Hey, Cass, you should come to my retreat.
I want to. Fly me out there.
No, tell us about the retreat, Marlene. What do you have in store? Well, I guess you do these frequently.
I want you to take us through. Oh, we can't come to your retreat, so do it right now. Ready, go.
Yeah, that'll happen.
Take us through some exercises. Seriously, what are the kind of things that you say and do with people?
Well, the thing about the retreat is that it's more than the reason why I want people to come. And I've done 8 of them, mm-hmm. and people say it's like a year of therapy because it's not just talking.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 10 people or less. It's a small group. And one of the big things is that you're with a small group of people that totally understand, you know, what I was saying earlier about mm-hmm. you can't go to people that are still in.
Oh, this is a safe place. How many days are you there?
3 days. Mm-hmm. And people tell their stories to each other, and that's really cathartic for a lot of people. It's the first time they've even told their story.
Mm-hmm.
But then we also do a lot of connecting, like you were talking about. We do some exercises that are about truly connecting. And for some people, they haven't done that before either. But then we do some rebuilding of the self, because the religion is also about self-annihilation.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh,
you're supposed to hate yourself and destroy yourself in order to be right with God.
Yeah. It's certainly so, debasing of what it means to be human. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And some of that is pretty amazing as far as what we do in order to do that. And then we do some things around the body and physical movement, and we also have music. We also have fun. We have talent night.
Cool. I would imagine, Marlene, that some of what people may achieve a breakthrough in is self-love.
Oh, yeah, big time, big time. And I really do believe in this idea of the inner child, because there is a part of you that's just innocent and, you know, needs nurturance and needs recovery, because we're all born pure and innocent. And that part, that emotional core, stays with you, even though another part of you can be grown up and mature. And actually is just as important, you know, the wise man that you are, that matures and takes care of that little kid that gets scared and says things like, oh my God, you know, that relationship with the self is what needs to replace that old dynamic of outsourcing that you've been taught to do,
mm-hmm.
to try and reach out to outside authority for love, for guidance, for strength, you know, all these habits that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I wanted to answer your question. Actually, I didn't really answer your question about what people are going through. And what I want to say is that it's actually, when people say, well, why is it necessary and why is it such a big deal? It's worse than people think, because for one thing, there's something that goes on in the church called, that I call phobia indoctrination.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That there's all this phobia, not just about what's going to happen after you die, but what's going to happen to you right here and now if you leave the group. Now, in some religions, like, okay, let's say Islam, the punishment for leaving is death,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
You're supposed to get killed. Well, In Jehovah's Witnesses, the punishment for leaving is you get disfellowshipped, which means that the whole church, including your family, is supposed to not speak to you and not associate with you at all, ever. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that is a killer. That is a horrible thing to go through. And by the way, I have clients that are from all these religions. Mormons go through a horrible kind of shunning. It's not disfellowshipping, but it's pretty bad. And then Christians get told that the atheists have this meaningless, horrible life, and that if you leave, you're going to become depressed, and you're going to, I don't know, become an alcoholic or a drug addict, or you're certainly going to, you know, have this terrible life and no friends, and everything's going to go wrong with your life. So if you do leave and anything goes wrong, you were talking about, you know, in traffic or whatever, but let's say you have trouble getting a job, or let's say you have trouble getting an apartment or anything at all. Suddenly it's like, oh, it's God.
Yep. You start saying maybe they were right.
Yeah, and so it's really, really hard to just make that move. Mm-hmm. And then to reach out and get help is an enormous, enormous step to take, because it's just fraught with all this fear that you call somebody for help. It's like calling Satan. My phone number is just Satan's phone number. So it's really serious. It's phobia indoctrination.
Sure. Do you think we should have schools that teach this to psychologists? Or is this just something you kind of pick up after you get the basic degree? It feels like there should be a place. We need more people like you out there helping people, you know, in this specific area.
I'm in the process of moving into the training area. For one thing, it's wrong for all of these psychology programs to simply treat religion like it's it's diversity. It's not diversity.
No.
The fact that there's that much suffering.
Sure.
So then when somebody gets depressed and then they interpret that, the other thing that's wrong with it is that, okay, so normally if you get depressed and then you get suicidal, why do people get suicidal? Isn't it when they think that life is not worth living?
Mm-hmm.
They're usually constructing something like that, right?
Right.
Well, when an ex-Christian gets depressed, they're doing more than that usually. Usually they're doing something more like, I'm not worth living. The self-degradation kicks in. I am a bad person. Everything that goes wrong is my fault. God is punishing me. Mm-hmm. And the apostasy idea is there. Apostasy is this evil idea that if you leave the religion, you've killed. There's this verse in the Bible about crucifying Christ again and how it's an unforgivable sin.
It's Hebrews 6. It's impossible for those who have once been enlightened, who have tasted the heavenly gift, who have shared in the Holy Spirit, who have tasted the goodness of the Word of God and the powers of the coming age, and who have fallen away to be brought back to repentance. To their loss, they are crucifying the Son of God all over again and subjecting him to public disgrace.
Wow. Jeez, they got this covered, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, truly.
That's a cult. That's what a cult does, is keeps the exit door closed.
Yeah, every possible thought you might have. Well, we got that. We got that taken care of. Wow. I'm telling you, it's creepy. I think it's creepy.
So in other words, if you leave, if you leave and you're not doing well, you can't even go back. You may as well kill yourself. So this afternoon, I'm going to talk to somebody who's never talked to anyone before about it, and he's suicidal. So the suicide hotlines, they don't know what they're dealing with. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
They don't know what they're dealing with. They're not dealing with people that are just suicidal because they're depressed. They're suicidal because not only have they left the religion, but God hates them now.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that something? Well, I'll tell you, what a great, and you should come around the country so we could come too.
Yeah, well,
I would love to take a class like that. Wouldn't that be great to help people like that? Marlene, if somebody wanted to, get involved or find out more about your retreats and what have you, do you have an email address that we could put out there?
Yeah. The website is journeyfree.org, and journeyfree.org @gmail is the email address to write to. But if you go to the website, there's a button that says schedule appointment. And what I offer is a free consultation, a free 20-minute consultation. If you click on there, you'll get a schedule, and you can just find a time that's convenient for you. and just make a time and feel free to put yourself in. If you want to give a Skype name, then I'll call you on Skype. Otherwise, I'll call you on the phone, and we can talk about your situation. It's not really a therapy session. It's just a little talk where you can tell me what's going on with you. Mm-hmm. And if you want to come to the retreat, then we can talk about that to see whether it's a good idea.
Sure.
You know, whether it's a good fit. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we can talk about other options. You can either talk about doing individual sessions with me, mm-hmm. or you can talk about joining the online support group. We have a confidential online support group that has a website that's 24/7 where people discuss things on forums and which has monthly conference calls.
That's a great service, really. Really is needed. Service. Absolutely.
You can feel so alone.
Oh, absolutely.
So, Marlene, let's shift gears. I want to wrap up with a couple of questions. We always ask everybody, so what do you think God is, or where do you stand on the notion of God?
Well, I think the question says it in itself. God is a notion.
Yeah.
God is a notion. God is something that people have come up with. It's an abstraction mm-hmm. that has been useful for a lot of things.
Sure, controlling people primarily. But so, do you identify with any kind of titles, like you agnostic, or you humanist, or you an atheist?
Animal.
Good answer.
Yeah.
So, and what about for you? What do you think the afterlife, or if there is one, or do we just die? We black out. It's over.
I think that at the moment I'm a collection of molecules vibrating in space with lots of space in between, and that my molecules will reconfigure themselves, and so I am eternal. In the universe as it is now, my molecules will reconfigure themselves into something else. So yeah, I will continue on, but not in my present state.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Okay. You were wanting to read or quote poetry when we were doing the sound check. Do you read poetry a lot?
Oh, that's right. We have some, who was it? Walt Whitman.
Yeah, actually, there's a little bit more to that poem. Can I read you another stanza?
Yeah.
It's Walt Whitman. This poem is very interesting because it's kind of heretical. This is song of myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagine being a Christian and thinking that was a good title for a poem.
Oh boy, yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah, I love Whitman's emphasis
Whitman's
on self love. Yeah,
Whitman is terrific. Yeah,
he was a heretic, so makes sense that
and
this
he was gay.
Sounds heretical.
Yeah, in fact, he's known as the poet that gave America its voice. Walt Whitman. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm gonna just read a little bit. I'll skip a bit too, but I just think it's really beautiful because the thing that I have to work the hardest on, and you know, I mean, people work really hard on this anyway. And by the way, I wanted to just say a tiny little bit, and I know you're out of time, but
no, we got all day.
Okay, the thing about animal, that's actually a very serious response on my part, because when I talk about evolutionary psychology, it has meant a lot to me to study that. And being an animal and understanding ourselves as a part of the animal kingdom and what it means to be an animal is huge. And the other day when I had a conference call with my group, there were 10 people on the call, or 12, and we had this conversation because religious people, and actually there's plenty of workaholic Americans that do this too, but religious people are constantly worried about being busy doing the right thing and doing God's will, and very worried about relaxing and doing nothing or doing the wrong thing. And so I was pointing out that if we're just one of the animals and we belong on the earth and we live here just like all of them, then if you look out your window or go for a walk and look at what the animals are doing and see whether they're always working hard and just notice, like I live here at the beach here and I look out and the seagulls, a lot of time, they're just sitting there on the sand for the longest time. And when there's a sunset, they line up and they watch the sunset. And they fly around. A lot of times they're doing nothing. A lot of times, and the squirrels, a lot of times, they're just running around doing nothing. There's a lot of lounging and loitering in the animal kingdom, including the bees and ants that we think are busy all the time.
Wow.
And, you know, that's the truth of it. I've done a little research on it, and I mentioned this in my book. Anyway, so I went on about this in this conference call, and it was so funny because everybody went, wow, huh, interesting. And then there's, of course, lots of other things about being an animal in terms of accepting your sexuality.
Yep.
Oh, my God. There is so much sexual damage
yep.
from religion.
Yeah, that is a can of worms that we haven't opened up, but it's the top one of the top three damaging elements of religion on yeah. sexuality, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
In religion there are these thought crimes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You look at a person sexually and you're supposed to be and you're committing a crime?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. So anyway, there's a whole lot about being an animal that's just amazingly wonderful and liberating. So, and it was funny because a couple weeks later, I'm talking to a client that was on that call, and I said, "Well, so what's your day been like?" And he's telling me all these things that he's had a great day, and he was sitting around doing this and that. And I said, "Is this because of the talk we had on the call?" He said, "Yeah, I took it to heart." And this is somebody who's been just racked with anxiety, and I thought this was a major success.
Yeah, breakthrough, absolutely.
Walt Whitman.
Okay, here it goes.
All right.
I celebrate myself and what I assume you shall assume. For every atom belongs to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of grass. The smoke of my own breath echoes, ripples, buzzed whispers, love root, silk thread, crotch and vine. My respiration and inspiration, the beating of my heart, the passing of blood and air through my lungs, the sniff of green grass and dry leaves and of the shore and dark-colored sea rocks and of hay in the barn, the sound of belched words of my voice, words loose to the eddies of the wind. A few light kisses, a few embraces, a reaching around of arms, the play of shine and shade on the trees as the supple boughs wag, the delight alone, or in the rush of the streets, or along the fields and hillsides, the feeling of health, the high noon trill, the song of me rising from bed and meeting the sun. Stop this day and night with me, and you shall possess the origin of all poems. You shall possess the good of the earth and sun. There are millions of suns left. You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on the specter in books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them from yourself. I have heard what the talkers were talking, the talk of the beginning and the end, but I do not talk of the beginning or the end. There was never any more inception than there is now, nor any more youth or age than there is now, and will never be any more perfection than there is now, nor any more heaven or hell than there is now.
Wow, that's yes, awesome.
That is beautiful.
That is just terrific.
You know, I think it's valuable about what you're doing, other than, you know, when you take a pacifier away from a baby and you don't replace it with a toy or something, you're going to get screams. And I think when people lose their religion, it's important to replace it with something else.
Yeah.
And this is an ideology, this is a paradigm, this is a new way of seeing yourself, a new way of seeing the world. And I think that's crucial to true therapy and true healing is, yeah, I've lost one paradigm, and if I don't create or reconstruct a new one, then I truly am going to be lost in the abyss, you know, the black hole of this vacuum that's left by religion.
Mm-hmm. Yes, good
so
point.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah,
we have a listener who has started sending us quotes, and we've committed to read one of them per week. And last week's was ironically very relevant. This week, I literally pulled it off the top, and I think it's going to be relevant. So this is a little quote by Charles Eliot Norton.
Okay,
one may sigh for all that one loses in giving up the old religion. But the new irreligion is the manlier, honester, and simpler thing, and affords a better theory of life and a more solid basis for morality.
Hmm. I would take out manlier, but I get that.
Yeah, that's probably a little dated. I don't know what.
Probably, yeah.
A little humaner.
Humaner.
So it's not a poem per se, it's just a quote.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
sure.
Just one may sigh for all that one loses, but the new irreligion, and I'm not familiar with that term. I like that.
It's
kind of like irreverent, but irreligious.
Yeah.
Is the more human, the more honest, mm-hmm. and the simpler thing, and affords better theory of life. I totally can attest to that.
Yeah.
I totally can attest. I have a much better theory of life than I did when I was a theist.
But it took you a while, didn't it?
A long while, yeah. You have to deconstruct, reconstruct, all of it, yeah.
And one of the lies, the biggest lie that religion tells you is that there's nothing out there. There's nothing out there for
you. It's meaningless, yeah. Yeah, that when you were talking about the fears of the Christians when they're, as you're on your way out the door, they, you know, they say, well, you're just going to fall into depression. It's meaningless out there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is nihilism. It's just assumed. I mean, because Nietzsche's accused of being nihilist, and he's not, and et cetera. Yeah. But there is this sense. I literally had a friend sit me down on a bench, park bench, and this was kind of our farewell. He said, I've seen what you're doing before. I have had friends who are on the exact same path that you're on now, and I know where this is going. And I'm sitting here today to forbid you to take one more step down that path.
Oh, boy.
Was this a Christian friend?
Yeah, Christian friend. To this day, he won't speak to me. I mean, you know, and we were best friends.
Wow.
Well, fuck him. That's what I say.
Well, by the way, you know, you were asking about the issues of people coming out. That's the other big thing, the losses of relationships. That's the crazy, crazy thing. For Christians or other religions to say that they are pro-family is just the biggest irony and hypocrisy.
It's one of the many. The whole thing is a giant irony, and it'd be laughable if it wasn't so sad.
Yeah,
Marlene, thank you so much.
You were great, fabulous, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. I had a great time. You guys are doing great work, so keep it up.
All right,
yeah, thanks.
Great talk.
All right,
bye bye. So, Marlene Wynell.
Wonderful. What a talk.
Author of Leaving the Fold.
Mm-hmm.
20 years ago, she wrote that book.
She's
been
something.
She's been helping people with what she calls religious trauma syndrome
right.
for 20 years.
Quite good. Quite
yeah,
good. And we didn't even scratch the surface. I have a sense that we could talk and talk and talk with her.
Yeah. But when I say it's a hard sell, I mean, I meant that.
I
think there's a degree in which people are like, you're just... you know, pity party, or you're mm-hmm. victimizing yourself over this or whatever. And
mm-hmm.
but what she clarified that I think was most poignant is that, yeah, there's a lot of people that were casual Christians, Christian light,
mm-hmm.
and so they're ripping that away from them is mm-hmm. just like walking away from it. It's
yeah.
not, those people aren't traumatized.
Right.
And most of
right.
the people that are skeptical of this syndrome
mm-hmm.
would be the people that didn't have, you know, their... tentacles all wrapped up into it in a devout, rigorous way. Those of us who did, we were all in.
Right.
100%.
And that explains, I think, you and me. You know, really.
That is.
This is the first time that I really got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were just completely
I was all
committed.
In. And you never were.
And I never, no.
And
I,
so to walk away was easy and painless, and you've looked at me and the trouble that I've had with dealing with post-religious trauma. And you've shaken your head, scratched your head. It's like, why do you overthink this?
Well, because
this?
I love you. I want good for you.
Well, of course,
and I
feel
can
the love.
See, you know, that
but,
this is
But you're right.
Me.
That does put, that's mm-hmm. you and I in a nutshell right there.
Yeah. Well, I was going through the internet, and I found something that I thought would be, you know, applicable to the stuff we're doing here. There was something a guy by the name of George Dvorsky came up with, and he says there are 8 logical fallacies that fuel anti-science sentiments, is how he put it. So, and his argument is humanity stands at like a better chance of success if we apply reason and the scientific method, all right? And then he said, but there are logical fallacies, you know, incorrect thinking. And the first, there's 8 of them. The first one is false equivalence. Now, false equivalence is, it's like, okay, let's have a debate with Bill Nye, the science guy, and that guy from the Creation Museum.
Yeah, Ken Ham.
Yeah, Ken Ham. Let's have those two talk. Because they're exactly the same. It's false equivalence, really. It's like on the news when they say, we must show fairness and balance, mm-hmm. is what news says, right? Mm-hmm. So what they do is they put on one scientist that says there is actual global warming or mm-hmm. something's happening with the climate change. And then they put on a lunatic fringe, right? 3% of the scientific population says, no, there isn't. It's fine. And they're presented 50-50.
Oh,
and
I
the
see.
Truth of the matter is, 97% of all scientists working in the field today say that, we're having this problem.
That's
with
false equivalence, I get
false
it.
False equivalence, right. To give them the same amount of... So if you are a guy that says, the world is flat, I'm a flat earther,
mm-hmm.
news would say, well, we have to show the other side. No, you don't.
Yeah.
It's been decided.
Yeah.
We've seen the pictures from space. There's a false equivalence there.
Yeah, so it's not a flip of the coin. It's not 50-50.
No, it isn't 50-50 at all. The next one is the appeal to nature and the naturalistic fallacy. And he writes, at the root of this conviction is the unfounded assumption that humanity's scientific and technological achievements somehow lie outside of nature.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the trope about the mad scientist.
Yeah, it's unnatural that you're messing with the genomes or something.
Yeah, unnatural, absolutely, yeah. Really wrong. But then again, when you take an aspirin, that's unnatural too, I suppose, huh?
Could be.
You know what I mean?
To some, it is.
Yeah, okay. So the next one is observation selection. And that's pretty clear.
Only looking at what you...
What you see, yeah. And that's what you perceive
filtering
to be true.
Filtering out what you don't agree with.
An appeal to faith.
Yep.
I'm not interested in evidence. I've got God.
God's
in
charge.
I've got Jesus. Jesus.
I'm not worried about global warming because God wouldn't let that happen. And if he did, he meant for it to happen. And so I'm going to be passive about doing anything about it.
So I'll be quiet about that. The God in the gaps theory is number five.
Yeah.
If you can't explain it, well... That's where God is,
yep.
Right? Until we explain it, then God's no longer there. So science does not have all the answers, nor does it pretend to have all the answers. We still don't know how consciousness works, this guy writes. We don't know what started the Big Bang, if something started it at all, or if even there was one, or maybe perhaps there are several. Mm-hmm. We don't know. But it's possible we will know someday.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the good thing about science. It keeps changing. This is the theory now until, we're going with... Newtonian gravitation for the time being,
mm-hmm.
and then Einstein comes along and he comes up with a new idea of mass and energy and what have you.
Yeah, a couple episodes back we talked about that Stephen Fry YouTube that went viral.
Yeah.
And I read Russell Brand's book, and Russell Brand now believes in God, and I have a lot of respect for Russell Brand, but Russell Brand made a video
mm-hmm.
that kind of was a reaction to the popularity of Stephen Fry's video.
Right.
And he was, the thing about science, and you've talked about this a lot as far as one thing that theists do and people that have like just world hypothesis paradigm
mm-hmm.
or everything happens for a reason. That to me is God in the gaps in a way, because they're basically saying, all right, you've got all of this explained, but you can't explain what started it all.
Therefore, everything is wrong.
Not everything's wrong, but that's God.
There's your God, right?
Because that's a gap.
Right.
And because a lot of people, you've seen this, oh my God, I used to preach this. If there are literally like 200 variables,
mm-hmm.
everything having to do with the orbit of the Earth, the distance from the sun, the seasons or the distance, the speed at which everything is spinning and orbiting.
The tilt of the Earth.
If mm-hmm. it was one iota off, then the Earth would be uninhabitable. And there's 200 variables like that.
Okay.
So what they're saying is there's no way.
How is that possible?
Exactly. Right, what are the odds of that being random?
Believe it or not, there are odds.
There are odds. And here's the thing, is it might be one in a million.
Yeah, yeah, there
it
are
It might
odds,
be one though. In 70,000 billion.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's still an odd.
Yeah.
It's still, that's enough for it to be possible without filling that gap lack thereof with God.
People don't understand the law of large numbers. They don't understand mathematics. They're not interested in science. It makes you think, and people just don't
They can't wrap
thing.
Their head around it.
Yeah.
I mean, we can't wrap.
Well, I'm not any kind of mathematician, that's for sure, but I get
the
it.
The truth is, we get it, but we don't get it. Like, we couldn't do that math.
No. Oh, no, you don't want me to do that.
Right. And so we don't get it. And where we feel stupid, that in itself is a gap. Our own ignorance, our own naivete or whatever.
Sure,
we fill it in because we're uncomfortable with not knowing. We're uncomfortable with anything unknown.
That's very true.
And
very
so in order to feel on top of things, we come up with, well, I may not be on top of this, but somebody is.
Right.
Because the thought that nobody's watching the shop, nobody's running the levers, no one's pulling the strings, we're literally just floating in space.
Ah! Yeah, really. Absolutely.
That's a panic attack.
Sure. The next one is...
All right, sorry. I derailed that.
No problem. Appeal to consequences. There's a fear that belief in evolution, for example, will lead to genocide, or that it will lead to, you know, the opinion that humans are animals. And we are animals.
And we're going to rape and murder.
Everything will fall apart, exactly. So that's what's going to happen if we let go of
Can I do the Penn Jillette quote here?
Yeah.
We have to, just in case nobody's heard it.
Okay.
Penn Jillette, famous atheist.
Right.
Illusionist.
Penn and Teller.
Penn and Teller. Well, as an atheist, why don't you just rape and murder anybody you want? And he said, I already have. As an atheist, I already have raped and murdered everybody that I want to. No one.
That's right, no one. Next one, almost done, number 7. Withholding consent. It's just a theory, in other words. When the people go, well, it's just a theory. And again, the problem is people don't understand the concept of theory. You know, they think theory is a guess. And it's not in the scientific world. A theory is probably about the highest thing you can have, even more than a law of something. A theory is a... Well, like, you know, evolution.
Theory of evolution.
Yeah.
Theory of gravity.
Theory of gravity, right. It is something that informs so many things and has been in use, you know, scientific use for hundreds and hundreds of years that it is so clear there's, you know, we wouldn't have the science of biology. We wouldn't have the science of geology.
Yeah.
All those things that evolution gives us. So
here's my take on that semantics.
Withholding consent is what it's called, yeah.
Well, withholding consent, but what you said that I want to talk about is the use of the word theory.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, that's just a humble position to take.
A theory?
No, you just, you know, it's a placeholder.
Okay, all right.
It's literally holding that place until we learn otherwise.
Right.
So the theory of gravity has been the placeholder for that theory.
Like a foundation, almost. It's a foundational notion.
Yeah, well, so we discovered gravity.
Right.
This is what we think it is.
Right.
And so that's why we're humbly referring to it as a theory.
Right.
Now, it's been there, and it probably will die there, like the Earth will die and we'll still have nothing. Nothing's going to replace that, but it's a placeholder.
Right.
So it's actually a humble use of the word. Think about this. When a doctor is doing his doctoring, what is he doing? Practicing.
He's practicing medicine.
That's right. That's a humble word. Basically, it's leaving open space that we're still learning.
Right.
I'm practicing medicine. I am not exacting religion.
Medicine. Yeah, I get that.
You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
It's a humble thing to say
The theory, right.
It's just a placeholder until we get the evidence to move it aside. It might stay there forever. For people to say, after all, it's just a theory. Well, it's the theory, right? It's the standing theory,
right? That informs current science at the present time. But science will change it if something better comes along. If something else explains it better.
And that something is not you, non-scientist.
No. Right.
We're not going to debunk the theory of gravity or evolution or anything else. Just because you're in denial. What's the ninth, the eighth, seventh?
The seventh one was withholding of consent.
You're all right. We presented you with a theory, and you cross your arms and say, "I don't consent."
Right. I don't consent
that's real or true. I disagree.
It's like Stephen Colbert. It doesn't feel right in my gut.
Yeah.
So no. I'm going to take my ball and go home.
I refuse to believe that.
And the last one is playing God, which is the non-secular...
The accusation.
Yeah, the corollary to the naturalistic fallacy. The idea that humanity should not tread on what is traditionally God's domain, and that by doing so we're being reckless, irreverent, those kind of things. So the playing God thing. Don't play God. And then he writes, if we don't play God, who will? Such was the central takeaway of the European Enlightenment, the rise of secular humanism, working under the assumption that God does not exist, or at least, you know, like a deist, he perhaps exists, but he's not paying attention.
He's not a sentient being.
Right. Popular opinion emerged that said, humanity has an obligation to take matters into its own hands if it is truly to understand the world and make it a better place.
I totally agree.
And that's called...
That's where religion does poison everything.
Yeah. So I thought that was kind of interesting, you know, to come up with the logical fallacies that sort of deny science.
All right, Bob. Thanks a lot, man.
Hey, it was always good.
Talk to you next week.
This was a great show. I enjoyed chatting with you and listening to Marlene. And we'll see you next week. I will